This is Night. Civilization, come to Appalachia. You participate by calling Night Calls national phone number 313-846-6601. Now here's Night Call host, Russ Gibb.
Hello, Night People. This is Gibb. Standing by in Washington, D.C. is Mr. John L. Sweeney, co-chairman of the Appalachia Regional Commission, a program to help people in a 12-state area in the United States. If you'd like to ask Mr. Sweeney a question about tonight's topic, why hasn't urbanization come to Appalachia, or make a comment, give us a call here at our national night call number. The number to call is area code 313-846-6601. Now remember, you may call from anywhere, collect. Please make the call station to station. The number to call, area code 313-846-6601. If you get a busy signal, just dial us again. Area code 313-846-6601. Mr. Sweeney, what is the Appalachia Program?
Well, the Appalachia Program represents an attempt by both the federal and the state governments in the Appalachian region to do something about this 12-state area, which has been so long depressed, both economically and because of that, socially. What the joint effort of the federal and state government really seeks to do is to take this area, which primarily in the past has depended upon mining and agriculture as its major sources of income, and try and provide the kinds of public facilities, the highways, the dams, the vocational training schools, the hospitals, the airports, that we think are essential in this area in order to enable it to attract the kind of industry, the kinds of jobs the rest of the American people enjoy. This area has a per capita income that's roughly 30% below that of the rest of the country. As you probably know nationally, the efforts that have been started to try and eliminate as much poverty as possible have determined that one out of every five Americans lives in a state of poverty. Well, in Appalachia, using the same standards, the same statistics, it's been determined that one out of three people who live in Appalachia have that kind of low level of income.
Now, you mentioned that these people live in poverty. Describe this poverty for me, not in terms of how much money they make, but what is their life like?
Well, I think in the hard core of Appalachia, in that part of it which once was dependent upon its once greatest resource, coal, the life is almost unbelievably bleak. These people, if you've seen the national magazine stories of them, which portray this position quite accurately, live in abandoned coal camps, tar paper shacks, strung out along winding river valleys, and along the seams of the coal mines, which have either been depleted or which are no longer economically mineable. They have no facilities whatsoever, no sewage, no water supply. The schools are terribly inadequate, and the roads make schooling even more impossible because school busing is a tremendous problem.
Are these Negroes or basically white people?
Appalachia is about 94% white, and the major Negro concentrations are not found in this kind of country, but are found in the big cities of Appalachia, Birmingham, Pittsburgh, and Knoxville.
Well, now, how is the Appalachian program different from the War on Poverty?
Well, I think that basically the War on Poverty seeks to take an individual who may be the victim of poor education, of poor health, of bad training so that he cannot find employment, and tries to take that individual and raise him to a position in which he does enjoy these kinds of decencies. The Appalachian program starts with the assumption that even if this were done in Appalachia, and we believe it will be done, we think the Economic Opportunity Program, the War on Poverty, will accomplish these things. And even when it's successful, there still has to be the means of livelihood in Appalachia. And that's why we have this heavy concentration on the public facilities there that will attract industry in to create the jobs that the Appalachians can then take.
Well, now, how are you attracting industries into the Appalachian area?
Well, we believe that most industry, like most people, are locating in rather sizable concentrations of population in the large cities of the country. Appalachia's major problem is it doesn't have these kinds of urban concentrations. It doesn't have the kind of cities, the wide variety of cities that you'll find in the rest of the nation. And we believe that in order for these cities to begin to grow as they should grow in Appalachia, they have to have these heavy investments. They have to have the kind of sewage treatment that's necessary, the kind of airports that are necessary, the kind of highways that connect them with each other, the kind of vocational training schools and hospitals, all of the kinds of services which are normally found in most of the rest of the United States.
Well, now, why have these people lagged behind in development?
Well, primarily because of what was the basic economy before. When you have an economy which is based on what the economists call extraction, the taking of minerals out of the soil or the cutting of timber off the top of it, or the trying to produce agricultural products also from the top of it, you don't get the kinds of concentrations of people, the kinds of city growth that you normally find in the rest of the country, where primarily it's been manufacturing that's created cities or great transportation complexes. Instead, you've got people strung out where the minerals and where the timber is. They tend to concentrate there in camps that really never really become urban settings, never really provide the kind of services that you find in cities. And when those industries die, as they have in Appalachia, you leave the people there without any of the services that, as I said, are normally enjoyed by most Americans.
Why haven't the industries taken a hand in helping these people?
I think that it's almost an historical fact in this country, as well as others all over this country, that industries which take from the land and have to move on, once you deplete a certain area, you move on to the next place that has an abundance of the resource you're after, you don't develop the kind of attachments that come with building a big plant where you keep it there and continue to manufacture goods. I think this has been traditionally the reason why those who have enjoyed the fruits of the Appalachian land in the past have not made the kinds of investments that you normally find in large manufacturing centers.
Well, now, why haven't these people marched as the Negro is marching in his fight for civil rights? Why haven't these people organized to fight this blight?
That, of course, is a very difficult question for me to answer, but I'd hazard this kind of a guess. The kinds of problems for which one marches are not really those which are guaranteed by our Constitution. I understand that there are a number of people in this country, and I'm not sure that I'm not one of them myself, that reads into the Constitution that we do indeed, because of our heritage, do really ensure every man a right to a job and a right to a decent livelihood. But I don't think there's any kind of consensus on that. On the other hand, the marching we've seen on the part of the American Negro is really on behalf of rights which I think the vast majority of us believe are guaranteed to him by the Constitution. And when he marches and when he protests, it's very difficult for most Americans to deny the cause for which he's marching.
Is the Appalachian Regional Commission a federal government agency?
No, it is not. It is, I think, an attempt, and one of the first in the country's history, combine the great wisdom and know-how of the states, who are much closer to the individual problems which we're trying to solve, along with the great financial power and additional expert knowledge that the federal government has. And so the unique nature of the Appalachian Commission results in a divided kind of vote in which the states exercise one half the vote and the federal government exercises the other.
And is it working?
Well, I can only tell you that up to this time, it's worked admirably well, and I might say that we have, as a commission, working hand-in-hand, federal and state government, allocated all of the highway money in the Appalachian program to the states that are involved with what I believe is so far not a dissent. And since the highway portion of the Appalachian program represents one of the major portions of it, I believe that the experience so far indicates that at least up to this stage we've been rather successful in maintaining this close cooperation and partnership.
Our guest tonight, Mr. John L. Sweeney. Our topic, Why Hasn't Urbanization Come to Appalachia? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Well, you see, here's what happened. I was just starting to pass the car ahead of me, and then he suddenly swung out and tried to pass the car ahead of him. I guess he never saw me. And that's when it happened.
Famous last words. I guess he never saw me. Now, the point is, as long as you saw him, accidents like that don't have to happen. Remember, safety first begins between the ears. Now, maybe you can't expect everybody to drive as well as you, but you can at least watch out for those who don't. You can watch out for their mistakes and sudden moves, like professional drivers do. For example, before passing another car on the highway, flash your lights or sound your horn. Let them know you're coming. Don't rely on other drivers to see you and keep out of your way. So protect yourself by driving defensively. Remember, nearly half the drivers in fatal accidents are in the right. So just being in the right is not enough. You could be dead right. So watch out for the other guy.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb. Hello again, Night People. Our guest tonight, Mr. John L. Sweeney, co-chairman of the Appalachia Regional Commission. And our topic, why hasn't urbanization come to Appalachia? If you'd like to make a comment or ask a question of Mr. Sweeney, give us a call here at our national Night Call number. That's area code 313-846-6601. Dial us direct. If you wish, you may make the call collect. The number, area code 313-846-6601. Our lines are now open, and we invite you to join us here at Night Call. Mr. Sweeney, exactly what does the Appalachian program intend to accomplish, and how long do you think it will take?
Well, the real objective is said in a different way, just a few months ago, is really to try and put those kinds of public facilities and those public investments in, which are designed to convince private industry, not just talking about manufacturing, but all private industry, commercial enterprises, recreational enterprises, all of the vast complex of employment employers that are found in the rest of the country to come to Appalachia and to thereby provide jobs. Now, that's a long process. Our program, by the bill that established the Appalachian Regional Commission, calls for a 6-year program of public investment. It's our belief that that program won't really begin to bear fruit until it's almost completed. And it may be, and we're hopeful that at that stage, private employers, looking at what's been done there, recognizing the commitment that both the federal government and the states have to this rather vast and extremely well-populated area of the country, will recognize it as what we believe it is, namely a good place in which to locate their new facilities, their new job-producing facilities.
Well, if it's so good, why did they leave in the first place?
I don't think it's a question of leaving. The real fact is that they really never were there to begin with, primarily because of the isolation that the mountain barriers represented. Historically, this mountain chain, the Appalachian Mountains, has been a barrier throughout our history. The first waves of immigration that took place in this country of eastward to westward movement bypassed this region. They went to the north of the mountains and to the south of the mountains. And the only real settlement that was made was of either the farmer or the man who was interested in taking the great coal out of the soil with the timber off the land. And no real manufacturing base was ever established there. It's been growing in the last 10 years. It's rapidly reaching a point where you might say that with a little more effort, Appalachia might become competitive with the rest of the country, and that's what we're hoping we can accelerate.
Well, does the geography lend itself to urbanization?
Very much so, because while the mountain barriers have been there, if access is provided, if you can break through those mountain barriers with the kinds of roads that are obviously the modern form of transportation, there is all kinds of land there, level or semi-level, which lends itself to any kind of development, be it residential or industrial. And I might add that one doesn't have to go much farther than Appalachia to find some of the most absolutely breathtaking scenery in the entire United States. so that you can combine all of the kinds of resources that manufacturing generally looks for: skilled labor, decent terrain, plus some of this magnificent land which man can use to recreate himself.
You mentioned that the people are living in poverty now in Appalachia, is that correct?
Well, a far more substantial number than there ought to be, that's right.
Well, why haven't these people moved out of Appalachia?
Well, the fact is that over the past two decades, more than 4 million of them have. Unfortunately, like most migration that takes place in this country, it's people with the best skills and the best training who have the best chance of being employed elsewhere who leave. And this further depresses the opportunities within the region itself, because as you and I both know, as everyone of the listeners know, a substantial part of any development effort or any progress comes right from the people themselves.
Well, why do you feel that your commission has the right to deliberately change their way of life? Obviously, they must like it or they would have moved, would they not?
Well, I don't, believe me, I don't think there's the slightest desire on the part of anybody in the Appalachian Commission to even remotely affect the individual lives of any person in Appalachia. We were told by all of the people in Appalachia when we made our tours long before this bill was ever drafted that they had certain problems which, if they had to depend upon their own resources, were going to remain insoluble. And that was the, for example, let me give you a classic example, the high cost of building roads in Appalachia. State resources, even with the present federal program, were just not enough to take care of a road building problem in which a mile of road in Appalachia cost about three times what it cost in the rest of the country, just because of these holes of mountains where you must break through them at periodic intervals. So there was a place where they told us if Appalachia was to progress, there had to be a road program of substantial magnitude, and they believed that it was a partnership of the federal and state government combined to provide those roads, and we think we responded to that one basic.
How much money are you planning to spend on your program?
Well, it's impossible to estimate the total over 2 years, and I'm not trying to duck that question, because the reason it's impossible is we can't really tell at this moment what will be appropriated nationally under a number of programs. I can tell you this, the bill that was enacted by Congress this year called for a $1.1 billion expenditure.
Is that million or billion?
Billion.
Billion.
Now, $840 million of that is devoted exclusively to highways.
First, you're dealing with an area of over 17 million people, aren't you?
That's right.
That doesn't seem like a great deal of money for 17 million people.
Well, of course it is not. And the real fact is, the federal government today, when you combine all the programs that are in existence, probably spends close to $6 billion each year in the Appalachian region. But these expenditures are pinpointed. They're aimed at providing just one thing and one thing alone, and that's a public facility base for the area, and we think that we can build the kind of highway network with these funds, put in the kinds of airports, provide the kinds of medical institutions, vocational training schools that will provide exactly what a growing industrial economy has to have.
Well, now this sounds vaguely like a grandiose TVA program. Is there any similarity?
Well, I think there's one major similarity, and that's that this program is confined to a region. It's against the statewide, it's against the nationwide program. Now, in terms of other objectives, I think the TVA started off primarily with a goal of harnessing that river so that it would no longer destroy each year the land that was so essential to any kind of life down there, both farming and urban land. And from there, obviously, when you harness a river, you can't exploit the hydroelectric power, and I think those were the two great desires of the Tennessee Valley program and ones that were monumentally realized. We've got, I think, a little bit broader objective, which is to take the whole arsenal of federal programs, road building and airport building, etc., and to expand them in Appalachia so that Appalachia's capacity in these areas is at least somewhat similar to that of the rest of the country.
You're priming the pump, is what you're saying.
I think that's right.
Now, how did you ever manage to get 12 states to agree on a program?
Well,
that seems to me practically an impossible task today.
Well, I must say that when you look back in it, in retrospect, that it does seem to be somewhat startling given the general competition that exists among states, but I think that the real fact is that the state started this program. It was back in 1960 that the Conference of Appalachian Governors was formed by governors who recognized that the problems in the Appalachian portions of their states were not going to be solved either by the federal government acting alone or by the states acting alone. There had to be a concerted effort. There was a recognition, for example, on the part of the governor of Maryland, that the people who lived out in the western portion of Maryland had problems that were far more similar to the people in eastern West Virginia than they were to the people in Baltimore. And they agreed that cooperative activity between these Appalachian regions was essential to any kind of real solution. So they started it. And the federal government came along and said, okay, if you've gotten together and you've decided on some basic things that you think you need, they sort of make sense to us, we'll go along with it.
Well, Mr. Sweeney, I have a caller now from Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL, a gentleman who's calling us from his car telephone, and he's in Howard County in Maryland, Mr. R.H. Wood, Jr. Hello, Mr. Wood. Speak right up. You're on night call.
I'm with you.
Yes.
Yes, this is Mr. R.H. Wood, Jr. I'm sitting right in the middle of Howard County at the moment.
Is that down in the Appalachia country?
It's on the south end of the Appalachian country. Due to the fact that we are in Maryland, we cannot speak for Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Your comment, Mr. Wood.
My comment is this, sir, and I'm listening to the program right now, and it states that these people are looking for jobs. My general superintendent was up through the Appalachian area and is familiar with it, and he asked those people to come back and go to work for us. And they told him that they could not leave their area. And he asked them why. They said, well, the mines will open later on. So my problem is this. With the present problem of employing more people, and I offer jobs to more people and open jobs to them, and they will not come to work for me, what am I supposed to do now?
John, you care to comment?
Well, I can only say this, Mr. Wood, that in every pursuit, whether it's the displaced automobile worker in Michigan or the displaced miner or the displaced railroad fireman, when he's been trained and has lived in a job for all of his life and has learned only that pursuit, that it's somewhat inevitable that he's going to hope and pray that the job that he once had will be his again. And we believe that in most instances it's going to be very tough to do something about that particular kind of individual, and I must say that I can't be too harsh on that. Our real hope is that we might be able to do something about the kids of that man and that woman when they grow up and are at the stage where they're going to look for a livelihood and take a job, they're going to have the means within the area in which they live and have obviously come to love to find the kind of employment that will persist and stay and not be dependent on the kinds of economies that the coal mining and farming industries have been in the past.
Mr. Wood, I want to thank you for your comments.
Can I ask one question?
Why, certainly, sir.
If we're on the air, how come I have WBAL on the line here and the gentleman that is talking to a gentleman in Pennsylvania?
Well, in Pennsylvania. Well, you're not listening to WBAL then.
Yes, I am, sir.
Well, I can't understand this because I think you've got some problems then. If you're listening to our show, our guest is in Washington, and that's where Mr. Sweeney is, and we're out here in the Midwest. I want to thank you for your comments, and I can't answer your problem of what's...
I don't want to create any problems, but as I say, I'm sitting in my car on the side of the road in the middle of Howard County, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir, Mr. R.H. Wood, Jr. from Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL. Our guest tonight is Mr. John L. Sweeney. Our topic, Why Hasn't Urbanization Come to Appalachia? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Hello.
I'm Sherry Lewis, but today I'm not going to talk about Lamb Chop or Charlie Horse. I want to talk about real children, children who have arthritis. Sounds impossible, doesn't it? We always seem to think arthritis only attacks older people. But listen.
We never gave it a thought of arthritis, being that the child was so young. Plus, whoever figured a baby would come up with arthritis.
My cat says meow, my dog says bow wow. Oh, listen, they're both talking now.
Well, there you have it. The reason why all of us must support medical research. Vital research that will someday bring a cure. And that's why I'm asking you to give. And give all you can to your arthritis foundation. For care today, for a cure tomorrow.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Our guest tonight, Mr. John L. Sweeney. He is the co-chairman of the Appalachia Regional Commission, a program to help people in a 12-state area. Our topic, why hasn't urbanization come to Appalachia? If you'd like to call us here at Night Call and express your opinion or make a comment, give us a buzz at area code 313-846-6601. Now, you may call from anywhere. Collect. Please make the call station to station. The number to call is area code 313-846-6601. Our lines are now open and we're accepting calls. Mr. Sweeney, I have a caller now from Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL, Dr. Gunther. Hello, doctor. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, sir.
Your comment, sir. Hello, doctor? Yes, your comment. Would you turn your radio down, doctor? Right, this is, sometimes we'll confuse you because there's a tape delay, and when you call us, please turn your radio down. Hello, doctor? Dr. Gunther?
Hello?
Yes, sir, your comment.
My comment first is this. I'm wondering what the commission may be able to do to sort of help the humanization of industry.
The humanization of industry?
Yes, what I mean by this, there was a very sound historical statement made by Mr. Sweeney that it is out of the very nature of things. People do have a way of taking what they can get out of the resources and putting out. And that the industries themselves don't actually stay in a situation. I imagine this. There must be made attractive the return of industry to the area or the actual attractiveness. In other words, what we're trying to do here, the government, I imagine, and everybody involved is trying to sell industry. Now, look, you can come back from here. You can work. These mines are gone, but there are other things. There's water power. There are people with a sense of dignity there, a love of freedom, and people who work. The thing that interests me is that while the great economic engine of our nation is an industrial and agricultural engine, and while the industry is constantly harm on the idea of individualism, of the open market and competition. Isn't there something that can be done psychologically, sociologically, and spiritually to sort of humanize the industry? I don't want to take too much time, but just as an example, when a factory or a corporation is working, they hire psychologists or sociologists or something to sort of personalize it. They do it as long as the profit motive can actually do its work. Then, when everything is gone, they have a way of leaving. When they leave, they say, well, anyway, anybody can get a job. Maybe this sounds like a garbled comment. We don't have much time to express ourselves this way, but does this make sense?
Mr. Sweeney, would you want to comment on that?
Well, I think the doctor's point is quite a valid one, but one which I think more and more...
May I turn the radio? I can't hear the answer.
Yes, go ahead and turn your radio up. Go ahead, John.
I think, Doctor, the point you made is quite a valid one. And,
all right, I'm there.
I think it's a valid point, one which, however, I believe that more and more American industries are coming to recognize. And I do believe that throughout the country, all sorts of managers of industry have recognized, whether they're motivated by their own self-interest or whether they're motivated by a sense of purpose and social consciousness, they are making an effort to ensure that the people, to the extent that it's possible, do find dignity and some pleasure and satisfaction in their work. I might add that they're being magnificently helped by the scientists and the engineers through what is sometimes invidiously described as automation, but which has done a monumental amount to take the drudgery and the monotony and the self-repeating kinds of indignities out of work. And I think the mining is a classic example. There are still a sizable number of people employed who are listed as miners in Appalachia, but less and less of them have to bend down back-breaking labor in unsafe conditions far underneath the earth, but instead they're trained people who operate machines that pull this coal out of the ground at a fantastic rate. And I really believe that while this obviously has reduced employment, it's done a great deal to bring some sense of dignity and a great accomplishment to the people who are still in that industry.
Dr. Gunther?
I'm here.
Yes, I want to thank you for calling Night Call and thank you for your comments. Good night, sir. Dr. Gunther, a listener on WBAL, a listener from Baltimore, Maryland. Mr. Sweeney, what can a local group do to aid this program, such as that you have with the Appalachian program? In other words, what can the individual do to help out?
Well, I think that because the individual in Appalachia, no matter where he is obviously as he is in the success of any other program, any place in the world or in this country, is the key to that success. There's just nothing he can't do to help this program if he really does believe that there's a chance to bring this great region back to the kind of dignity that it once had. Now, the whole key to the Appalachian program is to provide for local communities the things that they've said they need in order to enable them to then go out and bring in the jobs. And that's not an effort just of a few chosen people who are going to go out and try and sell some company to locate the plant. That's an effort that's got to be community-wide. It's got to involve an upgrading of school systems. It's got to mean that people are going to be concerned about their medical care. It's going to mean that people are going to be concerned about what the town looks like.
Concerned, but don't you have to be educated really to be concerned?
Well, I'm probably what a lot of people call too much of an egalitarian. I really believe that the people who recognize what kinds of problems before them can do jobs regardless of what year school they've had or what kind of real sophisticated training they've had. We've seen miracles worked in Appalachia in towns where if you look at the level of education in the community and contrast it to one of our nice suburbs outside of Washington, Detroit, or Chicago, you find a vast disparity. But these people have dug in, gotten themselves involved, gotten themselves grouped together so that they could work together to upgrade the town in which they live, and they've attracted industry in. This is happening all over the region, just as it's happening all over the rest of the country.
Do any of the monies go for education in the Act?
Well, they go for vocational training and for supplementing the construction of colleges and junior colleges. And I would like to take a moment on that, if you forgive me, because we've had some criticism from a number of people who are basically in favor of doing a great deal for Appalachia, who have said the real problem in Appalachia is education. Why doesn't the Appalachian program really concentrate on it? Well, there are really two reasons for that. Number one is you know, and every one of our listeners know, for we've been engaged for 20 years in a national debate as to what kind of an education program the federal government ought to undertake. And it was involved in a number of subsidiary issues, such as whether it should be unsegregated, whether it should go to parochial as well as public schools. Now, the Congress has resolved that question, and it resolved it effectively last year. When we were drafting the Appalachian program, we thought that had to happen before we could even talk to the Congress about a federal aid for Appalachian education. Now, it just so happens that the President's bill on education that's been enacted by the Congress looks like it was targeted for Appalachia. Appalachia, with about 7.5% of the school kids in the United States, will receive between 13 and 14% of all the funds, namely just about double what their population would require, and that's about the best we could have ever asked for from the Congress anyway. So that we really believe that the federal government is now undertaking the kind of support it ought to undertake. Now, secondly, the real fact about education in this country is the overwhelming bulk of support comes from state and local areas through the tax base that exists there. And if we were to spend three times as much money of the federal government on aid to education in Appalachia, we still wouldn't be able to give it the kind of educational system that's enjoyed by the other areas of the country, and that's because these other areas have industry to tax, wages to tax, sales to tax that enable them to pour these huge sums of money into paying teacher salaries and into building schools. And that's what we'd like to create in Appalachia, is that kind of a base of taxation which can then support the education that it needs.
Now, I notice that there is a clause here, and I'm reading the act in front of me now, something to the effect that monies can be spent for fish and wildlife projects and strip mining, is that? This doesn't seem to me like things that get right down to the heart of people. I mean, after all, fish and wildlife, they're important, but here I thought we were concerned about people.
Let me say this, I'd like to talk about both the number one in terms of fish and wildlife, number one in terms of strip mining. In terms of fish and wildlife, there is obviously one of the great possibilities for Appalachia lies in its natural beauty, magnificent rainfall that it has, which creates some of the greatest rivers in the United States. Well, these rivers and streams have been polluted, and almost unbelievably, not interesting enough by the normal means of manufacturing processes or residential discharge, but by mine drainage. With these coal mines, which have been abandoned, which get rained into and then seep out, the liquid that seeps out is a low-concentrate sulfuric acid, which into the streams and kills virtually everything within it. Well, we're hopeful that this fish and wildlife program will be able to restore a number of these streams. Now, in strip mining, you can't drive through any section of the coal country of Appalachia and not see this scarred land where the top has been taken off by the strip mine operator. And unfortunately, it's only been in the last 10 years that real legislation has come along to control this. These scars still remain, and here's the problem with them. Number one, they create drainage, they create erosion, they create siltation in these streams. And in many instances, they're adjacent to large metropolitan areas where land is at a premium because of the terrain, and you've got to restore this kind of land in order to ensure the kind of development you want. So we don't believe it's any less of a public facility investment than the highways. We think that in certain places in Appalachia where things have a chance of moving, they'll only move if you can reclaim this land.
And is it working? Are you reclaiming the land?
I must say this. The states have been doing this over a period of time. This will enable them, these extra funds will enable them to go in and do the job faster. And we've already approved a number of projects within the Appalachian region that are aimed exactly at this. Now, of course, the bulldozers haven't been put in operation because it's still a young act. But we hope by this time that we're back on the program again to be able to say, yes, we've reclaimed X number of acres of Appalachian land, which is going to be used in the near future for the following development purposes.
Our guest tonight, Mr. John L. Sweeney, co-chairman of the Appalachia Regional Commission. Our topic, Why Hasn't Urbanization Come to Appalachia? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
I was driving along. Well, this other guy comes up behind me and he starts riding my bumper. I have to make this turn, so I put on the brakes and he slams right into me. There's nothing I could do about it. You're trying to make a turn.
Nothing you could do about it? Nonsense. Maybe you can't stop careless or reckless drivers, but there's absolutely no reason why you can't watch out for them. You can defend yourself by staying out of their way. Yes, you can. Listen, when another driver tailgates your car, don't speed up. That just increases the danger. Slow down a little. Leave him plenty of time to pass you and go on his way. Now, that sounds simple, but believe me, it works. Now, some people call this sort of thing defensive driving. It's really just good common sense. After all, nearly half the drivers involved in fatal collisions are good drivers and in the right. But being in the right is not enough. You could be dead right. So watch out for the other guy.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb. Why hasn't urbanization come to Appalachia? That's our topic on Night Call tonight, and our guest is Mr. John L. Sweeney, who is co-chairman of the Appalachia Regional Commission. And our telephone lines are now open, and if you'd like to join us here at Night Call, give us a buzz at area code 313-846-6601. You may call from anywhere. Please make the call station to station. The number is area code 313-846-6601, and you may make that call collect if you wish. Area code 313-846-6601. Mr. Sweeney, how did you get the states and the federal government to cooperate, and what is the actual setup of the commission?
Well, each one of the states has a vote on the Appalachian Commission. Between them, collectively, they exercise what amounts to half the vote, because the law says this. The law says that no action may be taken by the commission. That means making additional recommendations or recommending projects, approving various disbursements of the commission's own funds.
Mm-hmm.
No action can be taken that doesn't have the vote of a majority of the governors, plus the vote of the federal co-chairman. So that there has to be at least a majority of the states in favor of a policy, and the federal government is represented by the vote of the federal co-chairman.
Say that nine states wanted to do something about pollution, and the other states didn't. Could the nine states override and force their decision on the states that didn't care to go along?
Well, if it involved... I mean, you picked a particularly tricky area, because that is sort of covered by a lot of history as to what kind of interstate waters. But let's say that they were decided on a program of purely interstate water, of cleaning up small streams that flowed into lakes, and that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
The nine states could obviously go ahead and do the work in their own states with the federal government providing the funds. There would be no way in which the three could force their will upon, the nine could force their will on the three and make them do it, and the law specifically states that no project can be forced on a state. But if it did involve interstate waters, where the pollution in one state occurring in one state was causing problems in the other, that's covered by a whole history of court decisions, federal actions, which override any kind of decision this commission might make.
Now, the federal government is putting up the majority of funds for this program, right?
That's right.
Do the states kick in anything?
Yes, they do, ranging from 20% to 90%, depending on the particular kind of project.
Well, now, isn't there a temptation for the states and for the federal government to become involved in pork barreling here?
Well, we think there is, but we believe, however, that if what we think is the key phrase in the Appalachian Bill, you'll find it there in the preamble, if it's followed by the commission, that a substantial part of pork barreling can be avoided. And that key phrase is that the Congress said that these funds shall be concentrated in areas which have a significant potential for growth, not to be scattered around to meet the political desires of local individuals who may exercise one degree of power or another, not to be just put down because there happens to be, at the moment, a particular need which, even if you meet it, may not ever really solve the long-range problem. We're hoping to put these funds into those areas in Appalachia which, because of both past history and because of what we can really see about the future, will really result in substantial growth in those areas.
Mr. Sweeney, I have a caller now from Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL, Mr. Charles E. Lundy. Hello, Charles. Speak right up. You're on night call, sir.
I would like to ask the gentleman there about this Appalachia. I used to live in this country.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to know why the people who destroyed and left that country in such poverty-stricken condition, why they don't have to pay for it, restoring it.
John?
Like the Morgans and the Carnegies and all those Pittsburgh magnates that robbed and took the mineral rights out of that country. Nothing but a wasteland there.
Mr. Sweeney.
Well, I think that you've hit, one of the questions which I think had it been asked and answered effectively 25, 30, maybe 50 years ago would have been relevant. I think probably we ought to have been debating it and coming up with probably the same answer that we have now and saying that through our income tax laws, et cetera, that, that those kinds of entrepreneurs ought to pay the cost. But it really can't be said today because it isn't traceable. The land's been abandoned. I don't think it solves any problems to continue the controversy. The real fact is the problem is there. It's got to be met. There's no way it can be met in the way you've suggested. And that's why I think the nation, through the Congress, has decided that it can't ignore it. It's got to act, and it has this act.
Charles, why did you leave that area?
I beg your pardon?
Why did you leave the Appalachian area?
I left there in 1940.
And had blight set in at this time?
The country was in good shape at that time. I mean everything was working.
Have you been back there recently?
Just 6 or 8 years ago, and I was horror-stricken what I saw, you know. It's a wasteland, you know.
Well, how did this manifest itself? What do you mean, a wasteland, Charles?
Well, I mean, you spoke of strip mining, the mountains are torn apart, the wildlife has run off, as you said before. The streams are polluted with all this waste. The land is completely destroyed by big business. And now they're trying to make use of the tax dollar to restore it.
Mr. Sweeney, we want to comment on that.
Well, I can only say this, that it really represents a repetition of it, that to my knowledge, a substantial number of responsible coal operators, steel mill operators, forestry operators are doing a magnificent job in restoring the land. There's still a large number who aren't. And we think that the states have got to enact the kind of legislation that will prevent them from destroying this land in the future. They expect to get federal assistance. But I don't think that we can reasonably talk about going back and asking those who did operate 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when they've abandoned any connection. I just don't think it's possible to trace those connections, to ask them to pay for it. And I think it's now become a federal problem, just as the kinds of exploitation that took place in some of our manufacturing industry had to be redressed by federal action, national action. You couldn't ask the packing house operators to go back and redo all the kinds of problems they created for their workers at the turn of the century. You had to do it through the federal government stepping in and providing assistance and help for them, and I think that's what we're doing in Appalachia.
Charles, I want to thank you for your comments.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Charles E. Lundy, a caller from Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Sweeney, how much money will each state get under the different sections of the Appalachian Act?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer because it really is based on need in given portions of the Act. Let me cite you a classic example. Obviously, in the strip mining areas, in the strip mine second to the bill, strip mine restoration and the putting out of underground mine fires and trying to fill up the voids that previous mining has created under some of the major cities, particularly in the region of Pennsylvania. Those kinds of dollars are not necessary in Georgia and South Carolina, where there's been virtually no mining at all. On the other hand, you take field like health, where it's in the hard core of Appalachia, where there's been no past expenditure, they obviously have a greater need for these health facilities than a state with, like Pennsylvania, which has had a far more effective and well-financed health program in the past. So we're really still in the business of assessing needs, and it's buried on the highways. I'd like to say that that's pretty clear. That mileage has been distributed, and it ranges from contribution of, say, $400 million in West Virginia, where construction costs are the highest, and where the needs are the greatest, to, say, $15 million in Alabama, which has been well serviced by the interstate road system. In the highways, we do know. It's very difficult for me to tick off state by state what each state will get, but I can assure you that the states are agreed. Kinds of broad formulas, which I think will result in an allocation of the funds that will be accepted by all of the states.
In effect, the Appalachia program is saying that the states are admitting that they cannot do this work by themselves, and that they must have the federal government to help them. Now, this is a little bit contrary to what we tend to think of states' rights, you know, where the state wants to do everything for itself. Have you had any effect of this, or any inkling that people object to this idea of bringing several states together to work out a problem?
No, and I'd like to offer a comment, which I hope doesn't sound facetious. The admission by the states of Appalachia that they cannot do the job themselves is only an echo of what all 50 states have been saying for about a quarter of a century, because the vast bulk of our federal expenditures are designed to supplement, to take up the slack in the kinds of services cannot be provided adequately in any of the 50 states. There's, the St. Lawrence Seaway is built with federal funds. It could just as easily be built by the St. Lawrence states. The Federal Reclamation Program, which has restored vast areas of the West, is a tacit admission that this had to be done by the federal government convention of the states. So I don't think there's been any problem with this. I doubt very much whether it will be a problem.
Do you believe that in 50 years that Appalachia will be completely changed?
Well, I can put it this way. If I were to say yes, I would be predicting, the universal success of this program. I do happen to believe this, that Appalachia has such enormous natural advantages that, yes, 50 years from now, it will look much different. It will be a far better place to live, and I would say that whether or not there was an Appalachian program. I believe the objective of the Appalachian program is to move the process along a little more swiftly.
Our guest tonight, Mr. John L. Sweeney, co-chairman of the Appalachia Regional Commission. Mr. Sweeney, thank you for being our guest on Night Call. We've enjoyed having you.
Our topic, why hasn't urbanization come to Appalachia? Tomorrow night on Night Call, our guest will be Mr. James G. Patton. Mr. Patton is president of the National Farmers Union. Our topic, the unseen revolution. Until tomorrow night, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station as a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life. Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.